Don't miss your chance to win $1 million. Applications for the 2024 Black Ambition Prize Competition are now open. Are you building a high-growth business in tech, healthcare, AI, media entertainment, or consumer goods and services? If so, we'd like to help you scale. Apply for a chance to win capital, coaching, and access to an amazing community of diverse innovators at blackambitionprize.com.
I never wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I certainly didn't want to have anything to do with food. I mean, I met my husband, Ray, in 1996. I was, I think, maybe 20. He was 19.
Back out to Allen. His three-pointer.
I realized really quickly he needed food to get him to his next athletic performance. I kind of went to the person that was an expert that I could find, and that was his mom.
I've been married 15 years, and my mother-in-law has not shared the pound cake recipe. She's just lying.
And today we're hearing from a former Heat star and his wife who have created a healthy alternative to fast food.
Grown, affordable, healthy food in minutes. Middletown native Shannon Allen planted this trend.
We had our second son, Walker. Walker, who was a brand new baby, he was only 17 months old, started having some really weird health stuff. So I find myself in an LA hospital, and for about 20 minutes, I tried to convince these doctors that Walker needed a blood test. And they spent 20 minutes trying to convince me that Walker wasn't sick. And then I stopped asking, and I just demanded. And 20 minutes later, the doctor walked in, tears, white as a ghost, and looked at me and said the words that will change my life forever.
All right, welcome, Shannon,
to
the show. So, Shannon Allen, right?
Yes.
The founder of Grown, which is an amazing, healthy, fast casual restaurant that I think disrupted like Miami food scene and other places, but like Miami food scene.
Thank you.
When you first opened. Also, we're going to dive into the reason why you founded Grown.
Okay.
And then you are a mother of five amazing kids and then also married to two-time NBA champion Ray Allen.
Mm-hmm.
And so officially welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm officially very grateful to be here with you.
Tell me, where are you from? And tell me a little bit about the journey leading up to founding Grown.
Okay. I'm from Connecticut. I'm from a town called Middletown, which is right in the middle of the state. And, you know, a lot of people don't know a lot about Connecticut, I find. Like, people know New York, they know Boston,
yeah.
Maybe a little bit like Providence, Rhode Island. But Connecticut's very under the radar. So I grew up in a town that's actually pretty diverse for a town in Connecticut. About 35, maybe 40% Black.
Mm-hmm.
Very working class. Very entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And oldest of three girls. My mom's the breadwinner in our family, which I think really set me up to really kind of sharpen those entrepreneurial muscles.
Yeah.
I have a very unique experience in where all of the Black women in my family are entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
I have one auntie that owned a hair salon, another auntie that owned a florist, another auntie that owned a gift shop. My uncle Michael owned an engineering firm. My uncle Butchie owned a cleaning company.
Right.
And so every single person in my mom's family owned a small business, and that's intentional. The reason was because my grandfather was the commissioner of minority small business for the state of Connecticut. Complete icon. His name's Francis J. Silva. May he rest in peace. And he grew up in Massachusetts. He's Cape Verdean by descent, and his family were farmers. My grandfather was brilliant. He graduated from high school at 14 years old and never went to college, but worked his way up in an engineering firm, building boat, I guess they were like trailers. It was called Mastercraft Trailer. He started off as a welder, and he worked and worked and worked, and he eventually bought the company from the owner of this company and was very successful for a bunch of years. And then the industry changed, and he had to close his business, and he went on to work for the state of Connecticut for Ella T. Grasso, who was also kind of an icon. And the set-aside programs that my grandfather built in the state are actually still being used today.
Wow.
And so I feel so incredibly blessed and grateful. We say a lot in our community that, like, I stand on
the shoulders
of giants, and that I'm my ancestors' wildest dreams. But I really do feel that in my own life. God, I hope I'm making my grandfather and my grandmother proud. But really, the example that they set and that he set as a Black man in America with no college education, no formal education, to have such a massive position for the state is pretty incredible. And I know that that's so unique because it really did kind of always allow me to dream about what it would be like to kind of have my own thing.
Yeah.
because that was so important to him. He wanted his kids to understand, if you really want to be able to be in America, to own a piece of America, to have your own financial freedom, to be able to live free as a free man or woman, as a Black person, you absolutely have to have financial literacy and you have to have financial freedom.
Absolutely.
The only way to do that is to have your own thing.
Absolutely.
So I learned that as a very young person, which I think is unique as far as the Black experience goes in this country.
No, I mean, financial freedom, financial liberation, the option to be able to move about the world, build things, buy things, own things.
Yeah.
Did you, so growing up in such an entrepreneurial family, but then also like a patriarch that was literally setting systems and things in place that exist to support entrepreneurs and businesses to this day, did you feel like you knew that you always wanted to be an entrepreneur, or did you feel some sort of sense of obligation to be an entrepreneur?
That is such a great question, because the truth is I ran from it. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom owns and operates the number one independently owned real estate company in Central Connecticut. She is absolutely a legend in our area. I mean, she just got awarded. She's 75, just got awarded by the NAACP last week, literally, for a lifetime achievement. And when she started out in the 70s, there was no Equal Opportunity Act. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted Black folks to own homes. Mm-hmm. To be able to have bank accounts, to be able to get loans, to live in their neighborhood. And so my mom really had to literally break down barriers. Yeah. Truly. I mean, people would stand outside of property with signs, "We don't want you here. We don't want your kind here." And it was very, very difficult for her to get families, bank relationships. Mm-hmm. Even now in 2023, she'll tell me stories about Black families or brown families, Latinx families that are in communities throughout the state that will say like, "Oh, my husband makes this, my wife makes this, or my wife makes this, my wife makes this." And banks will say, "Oh, well, you're approved for this amount of loan." Mm-hmm. And that amount of loan is an approval that would put you in a certain neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And my mom's like, "Well, hold up, wait a minute, something ain't right." And then she'll go to like 10 other mortgage lenders that she's had relationships with for 50 years and say, "Actually, no, you're approved for not a $400,000 loan, a $780,000 loan." Yeah. Because there's so much discrimination, like literally roped into the system. If anybody is looking for a book to read about this, read The Color of Law. Yeah. It is such a powerful book. My mom literally lived that as an entrepreneur. So I say that, Felicia, to say that I ran from wanting to be an entrepreneur, because the truth is my mom really belonged to the world. Mm-hmm. And my sisters and I didn't get a chance to see my mom a lot. She worked 90 hours a week.
Wow.
And we were so proud of her, and I'm still so proud of her. I have an immense admiration and adoration for my mother, and we're very close, and she's absolutely my mentor, which is another blessing to be able to tap into whenever I need to. But I did, A, never wanted to have children, and B, never wanted the responsibility of owning my own thing, because I saw how stressful it was for my mom to not only provide for the household, but also to be able to be responsible for the 50 people that worked alongside of her and for putting all these families in homes, because this was really her ministry. Yeah. She put everything into it. And so that meant that, you know, she wasn't at my piano recitals. Mm-hmm. She wasn't going to be able to come to my softball games. You know, I've never been out to lunch with my mom. I'll be 50 this year. Yeah. And I've literally never gone on a lunch date with my mother. And that's okay, because she's meant so many other things for me. But I had to work through that. And so I ran from the entrepreneurial DNA. And I ran towards the creative arts. I was a singer and a songwriter. Very similar to your last guest. You know, I wanted to be a creative. I did not want to be a business person.
Mm. We have so many similarities, right? Because my dad has owned a construction and development company for most of my life with his brother. I just remember being a kid and my dad just worked really long hours, never saw him, and came home dirty every day. Yeah. And I was like, "I don't want to do none of that."
Right. That looks too hard.
It looks too hard, too stressful. And I just didn't fully understand that they owned their business and fully what that meant as a kid. But like you said, when you become a teenager, then you're just like, "Well, my parents are not at this basketball game, and they're not at this, and they can't make that." And like that sacrifice of building something. And they're building legacy,
yes.
But you can't see it and fully understand it as a kid. What is your perspective now as a parent? Because now as a parent, I'm just like, I completely get what they were doing.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about, like, did the perspective for you change once you became a parent about what your mother was doing, what your grandfather was doing, and like their sacrifices for legacy?
Yes, I feel like my feelings and my relationship with it, that's the past, and I'm so appreciative for her, for everything that she built. I couldn't see it then. I was never mad at my mom. I was never resentful, but I missed her.
Yeah.
I had a longing for her, truly, but I've been able to work through that, and it did change the moment I had my own children, because I realized, my God, you know, for most people, the biggest investment they will ever make, and certainly for Black and Brown people in this country, the biggest investment they'll ever make is purchasing a home. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's our generational wealth. You know, you can take a mortgage out, you can put your kids through college, you can start a small business. And so in a lot of ways, my mom really was helping folks build generational wealth for the first time. So it wasn't even so much that she was providing for us and paying the mortgage and putting us through school and making sure we had food to eat. All of those things were real and tactile and necessary. Those were necessities. But the bigger picture of what she was doing was she was creating and inspiring an entire generation of folks in the community where I grew up to actually learn how to change the trajectory of their family's lives forever. Yeah. And when I started having my own kids, and I've got these five beautiful Black babies, and it's like, what can I do? Who do I have to kill for you? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I thought of when the babies came into my arms. Who do I have to kill for you? And that means everything, right? Mm-hmm. How do I provide for you? How do I care for you? How do I nourish you? How do I pour into you? How do I love you? How do I set you up for success? How do I give you wings? How do I support you to live your life of your own choosing so that in every room you walk in 100% yourself with confidence?
Yeah.
And when I felt that, I immediately understood my mother. Mm. Because as a Black woman, she did not want us to live in a room with brick ceilings. Mm-hmm. And so she was the fullness of who she was so that she could show us what that looked like. And I mean, my God, I'm nothing without my mother.
Yeah. There's also a history of like advocacy, right?
Yes.
Which is, I think, like the intersection of what you've built with, mm-hmm. with Grown. And mm-hmm. so there's the food side to that, but then there is a cause that brought you to that. So can you share a little bit more about the origin story of Grown?
Sure. So I think I mentioned it earlier. I never wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I certainly didn't want to have anything to do with food. I mean, I met my husband, Ray, in 1996. I was, I think, maybe 20. He was 19. Mm-hmm. And I realized really quickly he needed food to get him to his next athletic performance. And so I kind of went to the person that was an expert that I could find, and that was his mom. Mm. And at the time, I was in a girl group on Motown Records. My group was called Shades. We were signed by the late, great Andre Harrell. Mm. Rest in peace, Andre, the Kingmaker. So I was really living my dream. You know, Ray was getting ready to get drafted into the NBA. My first single dropped the next day. Mm. So I was literally and fully a singer, a songwriter, performing on stages with 70,000 people, touring, doing the damn thing. And I thought that was like, oh, this is my dream. I'm doing it. This is what I'm supposed to be doing on this earth. And then I met and fell in love with Ray, and kind of our love story began, and I kind of realized who he was and what was required of him and what would be required of a partner for him. And so while I'm doing all of my TV and film stuff, you know, we're building something. Mm-hmm. And it was evident to me really quickly on that this was actually a real thing. And so I wanted to be my own individual self, obviously, but I also wanted to be a good partner mm-hmm. because my parents have a great partnership. They've been married almost 53 years. And so I recognized that and I knew what that looked like. And so his mom helped me tremendously. She allowed me to be the sous chef in her kitchen, which, by the way, shout out Miss Allen, because, you know, a lot of times when you fall in love with someone and you meet and you learn someone and they have an amazing mom that's a strong mom, mm-hmm. you know, it's some ingredients in these recipes that don't get told.
They don't share. I've been married 15 years and my mother-in-law has not shared the pound cake recipe. She's just like,
She's like, you can have a bunch of stuff, but not that.
Or what it really is, that you got to come to Georgia for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Because if I share the recipe, then y'all have no reason to come anymore. So.
Right. So, but Miss Allen didn't do that. She didn't gatekeep. So it's like, when I make the macaroni and cheese, I'm making the macaroni and cheese. It's her macaroni and cheese. So she really is such a blessing in my life. But so I really started loving food and loving the process. That became like therapy for me. And it is so similar to the creative process that I would tap into, like that source energy for music.
Nice.
It's for me, it's the same feeling. Being in the studio, writing lyrics, coming up with a melody, writing something on the piano, getting in there, working out the vocal, you know, the vocal melodies and the harmonies and the vocal production is so similar to creating a meal.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you open your refrigerator and you're like, that's a blank piece of paper.
Right.
It's like,
how do these things come together?
Mom, what's for dinner is no different than a producer saying, Shan, you have anything for that?
Mm-hmm.
You got ad libs? It's the exact same energy. And so I fell in love with that rocking of the knife and this ability to be able to start creating again.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I loved it, but I didn't think it was going to be like my destiny.
Mm-hmm.
So we were living in Seattle at the time. My husband, Ray, was playing for the Seattle Supersonics. And I was pregnant with our first son, Ray. And I was just kind of living this thing where I was flying back and forth to LA, working on this TV show called Century City that Viola Davis starred in. And I was this kind of like online character. It was bizarre. I was like a personal assistant on this show. So I was going back and forth working. I was like, oh, this is happening for me. The CBS thing, which is cool. Coming home, you know, I'm pregnant with my first baby and I'm kind of a working mom. I'm still contributing to the GNP in my household, but you know, it's not a reality show. I'm doing what I do well.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought that was my life. And then after I had Ray Ray, it was like, ooh, I don't really want to fly back and forth anymore. And Ray was traveling sometimes 21 days out of the month. So like, who's home?
Right.
And I decided that I wanted that to be me because I didn't have that luxury growing up. My mom wasn't able to be home. So I fully dove in to this new identity and job. I treated it like a job of being the person that made our life work.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, well, then this is my life. This is what God wants me to do. And then we moved to Boston and we had our second son, Walker. And during the 2008 NBA Finals, Lakers Celtics, we were in California. Between a Monday and a Friday, Walker, who was a brand new baby, he was only 17 months old, started having some really weird health stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was excessively thirsty. He was wetting through his diaper,
mm-hmm.
which is unusual for a baby that was mostly on breastfed.
Yeah.
He was super lethargic. And then by Friday, which was after game four, heading into game five, Walker started using the words juice mommy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was only 17 months old. He had a pretty good vocabulary, about 50 words, but juice wasn't one of them.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is weird. Juice mommy. And so I was like, okay, my baby's just really thirsty and I'm just like pumping him with fluids. And then that night, Ray said to me, Shan, I think something's really wrong with Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, Ray, we're out here in LA. It's crazy. It's stressful. You know, you're here for your first championship. You've been waiting for this moment your whole life. We're all like, the anxiety is on another level.
Right.
He's probably picking up on that. And he was like, no,
something's not right.
Really wrong with Walker. And God bless Ray because he was paying attention. Mm-hmm. And so that next morning, the day of game five, I woke up to a puddle of urine. Walker was sleeping next to me in the bed. He completely soaked through his diaper, completely soaked the bed sheets. And he was like, Felicia, a wet noodle.
Mm.
And so I called the hotel concierge and asked if they had a doctor on staff. And they connected me by phone with a physician. No idea who this person is. To this day, I don't remember the name. And I told the doctor Walker symptoms, you know, bedwetting, soaked diaper, excessively thirsty, juice mommy, super lethargic, no fever, not really sure what's happening. And the doctor said, you know what? Sounds like the flu, but take him in.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, take him in. What am I asking for? He's like, no idea. Do not leave there without a blood test.
Mm.
And I said, okay. So what are we finding in the blood test? He's like, anything scary is going to show up on a blood test. Do not leave there without one. And those are the words that saved my life.
Mm.
So I find myself in an LA hospital, and for about 20 minutes, I tried to convince these doctors that Walker needed a blood test. And they spent 20 minutes trying to convince me that Walker wasn't sick. And then I stopped asking, and I just demanded.
Mm-hmm.
And 20 minutes later, the doctor walked in, tears, white as a ghost, and looked at me and said the words that will changed my life forever. Your blood sugar is supposed to be between 70 and 120. Mm-hmm. Walker's blood sugar is 639.
Oh my God.
He has type 1 diabetes, and he's entered a phase of diabetes called diabetic ketoacidosis, which means his blood sugar is poisoning him to death. And if he doesn't get insulin soon, you're going to lose him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so in that moment, it was like somebody pulled the rug out from underneath me, and I was just free falling through space. And the only thing that I could grab onto truly was God. Mm-hmm. And I just heard myself say, I don't know what diabetes is. I don't know anything about insulin, but give it to him because I'm not leaving here without my baby.
Right.
And I didn't want to claim anything because I know that God is in control. But in that moment, it was like, fuck everything. Mm-hmm. Literally nothing else matters. But me and my baby were walking out of here.
Yeah.
And so I called Ray. Obviously, he was on his way to game 5 for the NBA championship. And you know, there's this piece of you that's like, you love someone so much, you want to protect them from their own life.
Mm-hmm.
But we never did that. We've never walked on eggshells with each other. And even though this was the day he could have won an NBA championship, I was like, all right, this is the scenario. Walker has type 1 diabetes. They're saying if he doesn't get insulin now, we're going to lose him. This is our new life. And Ray says, thank God. And I'm like, thank God. Thank God? And he's like, yeah. Can we bring him home if we figure it out? And I said, yeah. And I said, he's going to have this forever until there's a cure. And he was like, thank God. We get to bring him home.
Because you now knew. Yeah.
And so he's like, do you need me today? And I said, you know what? Today might be the first day that I need you. But go play your game and then bring your ass back here. And if you watch the footage from that game, you see Ray, who is like this completely humble, private person. At the end of the game, he starts taking his clothes off on the court. He's literally running from these what used to be the Staples Center off the court in his underwear. Mm-hmm. Because that's how bad he was trying to get back to walkie. Mm. It was amazing. So that is what changed my life forever. And in an instant, I became an advocate, a warrior, an activist, a person that sat on International Board of Directors for Type 1 Diabetes for Research for a Cure. I was raising multi-millions of dollars, arguing with pharmaceutical companies, doing all the things. Yeah. And then one night I was on my way to the grocery store to buy stuff to make dinner. And I looked back at Walker in his car seat. Now, this is a two-year-old now, insulin dependent, and he's has a low blood sugar. And I could see that he's falling. Mm-hmm. And I pulled over real quick, checked his sugar. It was 40 and falling. I don't know if anybody knows anything about type 1 that's listening, but you can't get to zero. Mm-hmm. Zero is lights out. And I realized, oh, my God, I need food from a drive-thru. Mm-hmm. I grew up from food from a drive-thru. You know, my mom's a working woman, mm-hmm. right? So the McDonald's drive-thru was our friend. Well, McDonald's in the 70s isn't what McDonald's is at that time in 2018 yeah. or 2008. And so I start driving up and down the highway. First time I felt powerless, frustrated. I can't get what I need. I just wanted like gluten-free panko encrusted chicken tenders and unsweetened iced tea, something to get him out of the danger zone, but not to mess with his sugar.
Yeah.
And what were my options? A donut, mm-hmm. a taco with 98 ingredients, and the first one isn't even meat, right? And so I drove like a bat out of hell to a restaurant that I knew a friend that was a chef, and I jumped over the counter and I got him food and got him out of the danger zone. And then I kind of came home and like, had a bit of a pity party for myself and felt really bad for myself. Like, oh, the whole world is against you. And then I just kind of dusted myself off and was like, look, you know, if this is a problem for you, mm-hmm. this is just a problem, period.
Yeah.
You know, the world needs better. Busy people need better. And that was the moment that Grown was born. Mm-hmm. And so I called my husband, Ray, who was on a road trip and said, somebody's got to have big enough balls to reinvent fast food.
Right.
And it looks like that somebody's probably me.
Mm. Thank you for sharing your story,
asking.
Your family's story. There was a time between hearing the diagnosis for
yes.
your son. I'm sure there's always a bit of reassurance of, like, at least I now know what is happening to my son.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you go from, let me just take care of my son, to then advocating for so many? Because some people are just like, you know what, this is all that I can handle right now. I will figure out the solution for my family, my child, And then there's others that take the charge of like, this is a problem for me. It must be a problem for so many others. Like, just talk to us about that, because I think entrepreneurs grapple with that. Do I just focus on the money and building the company? Do I wear the hat of entrepreneur and advocate and being able to solve the problem for others? Can you just share a little bit more about like that thought process, that decision-making process?
Yeah. No one's ever asked me that before, and it's such a great question. And I have to, again, give the credit to my mom, mm-hmm. because in her real estate career, she also was an activist and very involved with the community. Everything from junior women's to Meals on Wheels to St. Vincent de Paul's Soup Kitchen, you know, the United Way, the NAACP. This woman was involved in everything because she could be. And I think she felt like it was her responsibility to not just be enough for us, but to be for whatever the need was. Yeah. And so I kind of had that example in my life. Mm-hmm. And right when Walker was diagnosed, everyone in our lives gave us this piece of advice. This is a personal, private, family issue. We don't talk about what's going on at the doctor's office. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, Walker's here. He's been spared. Let's go win this championship. We'll figure it all out later. And we'll move forward and we'll start working ways to donate money and use our resources to push us closer to cure. And I said, no, what is that going to do? Right. We almost lost Walker because we didn't know the warning signs. Yeah. Ray is right now on the biggest stage he's ever been in his entire life. This is Celtics Lakers. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the big three and the late, great Kobe Bryant. Yeah. And it felt like at the time the whole world was watching. And I'm like, do you think that God put us in this situation and we almost lose our baby after you just made the most three-pointers ever in the history of an NBA game? You had 8 three-pointers in the fourth quarter to come and win after a almost 30-point deficit to now almost lose your son and we're going to stay mum about it?
Yeah.
No, no. And he was like, Shan, you're 100% right. We have a stage. Most people don't have a stage, Felicia. Yeah. Most people don't get invited into the boardroom. Most people don't have a seat at the table. Most people don't. You can stand outside all day long crying and screaming until you're blue in the face. Help me. My child needs. And no one is listening. And we have that. And we're not going to use it. No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So we immediately made a public statement. Immediately. That went viral. And within weeks, we did a commercial for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, like boom.
Yeah.
And Walker became the face of type 1 diabetes, mm-hmm. literally. And I truly believe that Walker was spared to help let folks know what the warning signs are.
Absolutely.
And potentially save some lives. Mm-hmm. And so we had to do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was a decision that we made, if I'm being honest. Mm-hmm.
It was just
listening to our guts, mm-hmm. and going towards what we would hope someone else would have done for us.
Absolutely.
And so, yes, there was a lot of like missteps along the way, I'm sure. And there were definitely times that I was dragging my kids all over God's green earth to go to these board meetings and speak at Congress and for special diabetes funding and walks and rides and charity events. And I was a nursing mom and I was dragging my kids everywhere. But I kept thinking like, yes, this is for Walker, but this is also for the millions of people like Walker that don't have the luxury,
yeah.
of having the strength of the National Basketball Association standing next to them. And friends that are celebrities and have stages and resources. We got to use whatever we've got.
Mm-hmm. So going from like advocacy, right?
Yes.
The boardrooms that you talked about, the meetings, bringing like massive, big, powerful partners together to then transitioning to, all right, well, how do I make this accessible to neighborhoods,
yeah.
right? And everyday families that need healthy choices, but need healthy choices fast in this in the form of like
fast food, yeah,
right?
Drive through window.
And I remember, I think reading or hearing about when you launched Grown, mm-hmm. down in South Dade, Coral Gables area, and like how exciting it was in the simplicity of just like healthy food should have a drive through. So it's just, and it sounds like a no brainer now, but like back then, I remember it was just that was like. the big thing. It was simple, but it was a big thing that just did not click for people. And so talk us through getting the restaurant open and like some of the impact that it has had.
Okay, thank you. Well, I will definitely tell you that it seems very simple. I literally just created the thing that I wished existed. And at the time, it was so controversial. And every single person that I talked to about it said, this is never going to happen. And if it does happen, you're the really wrong person to do it. You know, woman of color, married to a professional athlete, 5 kids, one of them who has a serious medical condition. Baby, you are not her. This isn't going to work. You know, the average restaurant is out of business in 3 months. And then 99% of restaurants are out of business in a year. And the 1% of 1% that makes it past a year are out in 3 years. And forget it after that. It doesn't even happen. And I just really believed, you know, it's the like the audacity of the belief in yourself, in God, in your ability, in not even caring, but just saying, I need this. So even if I'm the only person that shows up, I know I need this. And yes, I hope I'm solving a lot of other people's problems as well. But like, I can't get out of a car. I need a drive-through window. Like, this seems so obvious. Yeah. It seems so obvious. And so I just threw caution to the wind and just did it. And I kind of do everything with reckless abandon. It's like, if I want to do it, I want to be a singer, I'm going to do it. If I want to be a songwriter, I'm going to do it. If I want to be an actor, I'm doing it. If I want to write a TV show, do it. If I want to executive produce a TV show, I'm doing it. Yeah. And I don't know. I think like not caring what other people think about you is a superpower.
Yeah. But how do you get to...
Felicia, I don't know.
How do you get to that point of not caring what other people think? Because I am there, right?
Okay.
Like I was just like, but you go through so much.
Yes.
And then you realize that these people have, why do they have real estate in your life? Why do they have agency? But there's like a process, I think, in which you get to the point where like, I am just going to do what I'm put on this earth to do, whether people like it or not. Like, was there a moment for you where you're just like, I can put blinders on. I do not see anyone that is like not on board with where I'm going, with what I'm building.
You know, that is what motivated me. You know, on my way over here, I was listening to your partner Pharrell's song, So Ambitious, with Jay-Z. And that's literally what the song is about. It's literally what your podcast is about. It's about doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Doing it anyway. Okay, so I'm crazy. I'm doing it anyway. Okay, I'm not qualified. I'm doing it anyway. I don't have the money. I'm doing it anyway. Yeah. I don't believe in the word no. The door's locked. Go through the motherfucking basement. You don't have a basement? Show me the chimney. Yeah. There's no chimney. Let me take a look at that window. There's always a way. And you know what the proof is? The proof is math. The proof is science. One, we are sitting on a blue ball floating in the middle of nowhere right now.
That is true.
Our phones are powered by crystals. Our brains are powered by crystals. None of it makes sense. So you telling me we can't serve real food out a drive-through window? Like, it's just so simple. It's so simple, it's scary.
Yeah.
Now, scaling it, executing the dream, finding the resources to do it, hearing the word no a million times and not actually falling victim to that is challenging.
Right.
And there have been so many times when I'm like, Lord, if this is not what you want me to be doing, I'm okay with that too. You know, because I want you to order my steps. And if this isn't what you really wanted me to be doing, that's fine, because I actually don't know how I'm gonna make it through payroll on Friday. It's not like I haven't had those moments. I've had those moments. I have those moments. That is real life. That is business. And no one ever talks about how hard it is. But from a perspective of, can I provide blackened salmon, sweet mash, and broccoli out of a drive-through window? Yes.
In a timely manner before the buzzer goes off.
Yeah. Yes, we can. And I think the other part of this challenge and why you're so powerful in what you're doing is that having Black ambition is so key, because it's so easy to believe that we don't belong here.
Yeah.
It's so easy to fall into this belief system that there are limits on what we can accomplish. And it's so easy to forget who we really are. And every single person that I told this idea to told me that it was impossible. And even when I went back, hey, I didn't go out of business the first 3 months. Actually, I made $1 million in 3 months. You know, hey, I didn't go out of business the first year. I actually made $3 million this year out of 1,900 square feet. Do you know that only 1% of small businesses in the United States ever makes $1 million in revenue? And I made $1 million literally in 90 days because of God and the strength of the community and people seeing my enthusiasm and passion and wanting and needing what we were offering out of that drive-through window. This is a real thing and it works. People would still say to me, I know what you've accomplished with sheer grit and determination, and that's awesome, but I'll never invest in you. Mm. Not you, a woman of color, no traditional restaurant experience, no master's degree. Yeah. You didn't go to Wharton. You didn't go to Harvard. You didn't go to Yale. Your husband's a professional athlete. He needs to just relax and continue to dribble the basketball. Mm. You've got 5 kids. What? Yeah. And one of them has a medical condition? Baby, you're going to burn out. I can't invest a dollar with you. Okay, but you'll give your money to Sam Bankman-Fried. And you'll give your money to Bernie Madoff. Yeah. This isn't an idea on the back of a napkin, baby. It's a real thing. You can go there right now and get a fresh pressed green juice. I'm not selling you anything that's not real. That's the problem, though. Yeah. Because of all the venture money that's raised in this country, we know the numbers. Only 2% of those dollars ever even touch women's hands. And Black women, we don't even get to sniff it.
Yeah.
And that's why we need you. And that's actually why we need me.
Yeah.
And that's why we need my mom in the 70s. And that's why we need my daughter as a doula who's a business person. It's like, it's not enough to open the door a crack. It's not enough to offer somebody a seat at the table. It's not even enough to build a banquet hall. We gotta be dragging our sisters through the door by their baby hairs and building massive, massive scale empires where we sit. You know, because who else is going to look out for us?
But us. What does success look like for you? Because I hear what you, I hear this part, right? Like, that's a big part of success I'm hearing. Of, like, not only pushing the door open, but leaving it wide open for more women to be building companies at scale.
Yes.
Getting the respectable amount of funding that they need. But then also finding like a cure for type 1 diabetes, or at least more support around that. What else does success look like for you?
One, I'm not going to be satisfied until Grown is the McDonald's of the future, because we need it. You know, the big guys are great and they offer a real service to the world. And if I sat here and said to you that I don't go through the Raising Cane's drive-through or the Starbucks drive-through, I would be lying to you. There aren't enough Groans yet. And so I still support fast food restaurants because literally need this in my life. I do. But what's being offered needs to change. It really does. And so we know what happens in our communities with obesity and type 2 diabetes, hypertension. Heart disease is the number one killer of Black women. My mom has congestive heart failure. I have the gene for heart failure. So I'm always trying to figure out ways to support us for longer, more active lives and healthier lifestyles, certainly. Regenerative agriculture, organic food. You know, we always talk about the people's carbon footprint and what are we doing around sustainability in the world. Well, our soil is down to 1.5 soil turns. People don't even know what that means. It's like we've got 1.5 more times to turn our soil over in the United States before we can't produce food with nutrition anymore.
Wow.
That's what we've done. We've been chasing the almighty dollar for so long that we've cut the farmer, the regenerative farmer, you know, these masters in agriculture, and we've ruined our seeds. Forget about animal husbandry. We've absolutely destroyed what it looks like to respectfully mature and grow and nurture animals for consumption. And we're staring down the mother of all messes. So it's not just a like, I want to do it because of Grown, because I'm an organic certified facility and our bodies need it and we shouldn't be consuming known carcinogens. But the world needs it. The world needs us to be more responsible about how we're planting, how we're growing, and how we're producing food for the masses. It's really necessary. So that's the Grown piece, you know, global domination. And inspiring people to eat better and to live longer, fuller lives, certainly. The diabetes piece, I'm not going to be satisfied until there's a cure for Walker and everybody like him. I mean, I'm just not going to be. We find cures all the time. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the cure is coming for Walker. And then from a personal perspective, There's a couple different things. I'm never not going to be thinking about my first love, which is music. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to stop writing and recording because it's like when I'm at the seat of my soul. And I'm never going to stop like writing and ideating around TV and film because it's passion for me personally. And it fills me up inside. And when I think about it, my eyes like light up from the inside. But the true, like, what is success for me really has nothing to do with activism, advocacy, or my entrepreneurial prowess. The true success for me is that I have my relationship with God and my relationship with my husband and kids, and that the world is using me and I am of service. That's got to be it for me.
Yeah.
Truly, because those five people, those babies are literally, and we talked about this earlier, the best part of my life. And my relationship with my husband is super important to me. My relationship with our family and being in service to the community. Last week, and I didn't get a chance to tell you this, but last week, the governor of Connecticut, Governor Ned Lamont, appointed me to the CT Innovations Board, which is a massive venture fund that the state of Connecticut has, where they are trying to put in place attracting new companies and founders, and specifically diverse founders, to the state to ensure that the state isn't just a great place to live, it's a great place to work. And there's 17 people on the board. I'm the youngest and I'm the only woman of color. And for me, Felicia, honestly, this feels like such an anointing, and I'm so grateful for it because I have to believe that my grandfather, you know, from the great beyond, had a hand in this, that now I can sit at the table and have an opportunity to make sure that resources, investment are earmarked for Black women.
I love it.
It's crazy. I'm so excited about this CT Innovations, and you need to talk to me and I need to talk to you, because if founders want a headquarter in the state of Connecticut, there's money for them.
I love it. I love it.
I'm really excited about this piece.
Literally, like, the footsteps from your grandfather.
I can't even believe it. It's like a pinch me moment.
Nice. I love it. We do have to chat.
We do.
One last question. And you've been transparent about one of your store's locations closing.
Yes.
And I remember when my husband and I had to close our store in Midtown yes. Shops years ago. And like looking for resources on just like a checklist of like, how do you close a like brick and mortar? There was nothing. And what that further said to me is like, people don't like to talk about
failures.
The ebb and flow or failures that happen, especially when it's very public, right? Closing a brick and mortar is public. The life that you live, right, is also extremely public. And you had so many people tell you to not even like start to begin with.
Right.
Can you share just a little bit about like either the decision to close and then what that means? Because you have other things that are coming out. And sometimes you need to close one area in order to be able to open up the other. But can you share just a little bit about that journey? Because some entrepreneurs are just like, I need to like transition from this. I don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of people that share the story of having to close in order to make a different move in their business.
This is a really hard one. Truly, because I'm with you on that. And it is difficult for me to talk about things that don't work, but it's about reframing it from failure. Like, losses are just lessons. And I think the goal is to learn the lesson as fast as you possibly can. People always say fail fast. And I used to be like, fail fast. I don't want to fail at all. I'm not going to fail at all. Right. You have like this, the ego.
Yeah.
But you are failing. You're constantly failing. You're constantly making mistakes. You're constantly experiencing losses and lessons. And I wish I knew how to do that quicker, because I've actually opened and closed a bunch of different stuff. Because I think true entrepreneurs are not risk averse.
Yeah.
We love risks. We are like, throw me out of the plane and I'll build a parachute on the way down. Like, that is our energy.
As a joy and pleasure.
Yes. You're like, oh, set me on fire. Let's do this thing. I got to figure out how to put it out. And so I think that's like a part of our ethos and our culture as entrepreneurs. But I wish I had learned how to do that quicker. So during COVID, I actually closed a couple of units. I kept my flagship open and this new one that I was opening. very similar to your last guest. I went into my savings account. I, you know, sold my Apple stock. I deleted my Roth IRA. I just wanted to keep my business open. I was like, I got to feed my baby. My grandfather used to always say that, feed the baby, feed the baby. And so, you know, I absolutely did that. But it is still hard because there are moments where you feel like, oh, am I making the right decision? And, you know, you don't want to save your fingernail and lose your hand.
Right.
And sometimes you do have to do that. Get leaner, pivot, you know, get in the weeds with it and figure out, okay, this is the ugly part of my business I really don't want to look at. But if I don't look at it and I don't dissect it, I'm never going to be stronger. And that's one of those things that I think my husband has taught me a lot. And I've gleaned a lot of kitchen wisdom from him through osmosis because he's so excellent. He brings so much excellence to everything he does. Yeah. He never cuts corners. I mean, the reason he's been so successful in basketball all these years and now coaching and certainly golf and any of the things that he tries to do in life, he is so obsessed and committed to doing the small things to exhaustion and perfection every single day when no one's looking and then coming back again and doing them tomorrow. He loves that process. I hate that process. I don't want anybody to break me down and build me back up again. I don't want to stand naked in front of anyone and be judged. It's like I have the opposite of body dysmorphia. I always think I look good. Like it's crazy. But that's what I think risk takers need.
Yeah.
It's like, whatever, throw mud at me. I don't care. I look good in mud.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the losses and the lessons.
Yeah.
It's like this one particular location, I didn't want to let it go because it was so beautiful and it was so elegant and it was so like perfectly appointed and it was in such an incredible location.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all of this space where I could not only do the grown thing that we do our organic song and dance, but also to host companies and organizations and philanthropic ventures that I believe in,
mm-hmm.
you know, like you guys, the Center for Black Innovation, UNICEF, Emerge Americas, Trinidad James came and we did something for him, Dwayne Wade, Wade Sellers, just constantly doing stuff, Chase Bank, to hold space for folks where I wasn't charging them an arm and a leg. And it was like, but this is your home too.
Right.
But we actually had a racist person that lived in the building where we were operating out of that would stand outside of our venue and verbally assault our guests.
Oh my God.
With racial slurs because they did not want a black female owned business in the building. And, you know, I'm a fighter. It's like I've never kind of like met a fight I didn't like. But this was so exhausting.
Of course.
And I'm not a litigious person. And I just felt like, what am I getting out of this? Like I'm literally every day, this is taking my personal power. It's taking my energy that I could be pouring into my franchise business or my new meal plan subscription delivery service business, Lunchology, that I purchased from a friend, or my new, you know, comfort food menu, Grown Southern, that I built with Chef Richard Ingraham and Soleil Rodriguez. Like there's so many great things I have going on in my life. Fighting this racist motherfucker is just not what it's going to be for me.
Yeah, it derails you from being focused
it's
on
like, bro, you got it.
You're
good. So I closed that location. I was just like, I don't want this energy in my life. I'm done with this. And the minute that I did it, it was like, whew, Lord, thank you. Because it was like I was carrying this burden of this fight. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And so it was like, whatever. Mm. And sometimes I think that's actually what it is.
Yeah.
Being okay with letting go and letting God.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, God, you've got the wheel. Like, you've never steered me wrong before. You're not going to do it now. Just, I don't need to see the whole staircase. I'll take the first step. Nice. So I did.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Because I guess so many people won't share.
Yeah.
They'll gloss over it.
It's hard.
Minimize it. And it's hard when you're building something and you're met with hate at that level. And the energy that person was wasted, like it's wasted energy to hate, right?
And it's like, bro, we have an organic certified restaurant here. Like we're serving families, like juices and smoothies and acai bowls. Why is this so offensive to you? I just got to know.
Yeah.
But whatever, you got it.
My last question, what's next for you and Grown?
So in 2024, we are officially going to be set up. We're already set up, but I will be officially awarding Grown franchises.
Nice.
Woo. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's time to scale. You know, COVID was so difficult. And I know you've talked about this with other guests. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we almost lost it. Like literally, it's like you just are holding on for dear life. I did not want my team members to have to go on an unemployment line. They have been with me and they've been so down with me and they believe in my mission. I mean, my original dishwasher, Anton Jones, who started with me in 2015, still works with me at Grown every day. I could not have looked at Anton and been like, Anton, today's the end of the road for us. No, fuck that. Like, I've got to figure out a way to push through this. And, you know, to God be the glory because we're here. I doubled my revenue last year.
Yes.
And it's just like, now's the time. This is God's way of saying, you tried a bunch of things. Some things worked, some things didn't. But it's time for you to push the button and literally grow. Like the word grow, growth, growing, grown ass woman, like this is in our DNA. Mm-hmm. We have to do it. We can't stay stagnant. So yeah, 2024, baby.
Awesome. Shannon, let everyone know where they can find you online. Yes. And then continue to follow you on your journey.
Okay, please join us at our gorgeous flagship location in South Miami, which is 8211 South Dixie Highway. If you're in the Miami area, it's the corner of US 1 and 67th. And you could order us also through all of the at-home contactless delivery apps.
That's what I do.
Thank you. And you can also visit us on social media at Grown, literally one word. We also have a company that I bought last year through a very incredible, another Black woman entrepreneur. It's called Lunchology. So if you visit us at lunchology.co, that's an organic meal plan delivery service. It's a subscription program. So we deliver all of your food to you. So you don't have to leave the house, take care of it for you. And on the web, we're grown.org. So please come chill with us. We have a very robust catering business that no one really knows about. Actually, can I tell you guys this? Because this is something I'm really proud of. We've been feeding a lot of professional sports teams, very under the radar because we don't like to, you know, talk out of school. But all of your favorites, we feed them when they're in town playing against the Miami Heat and at the Dolphins Stadium, certainly, and then also for baseball. And we feed a lot of collegiate athletes as well. And one of the biggest blessings of our entrepreneurial life is that we have consistently fed the University of Miami Canes football team for almost 8 years now.
Wow.
But this year is the first time that we have ever been able to actually be in partnership with the University of Miami's nutrition program. So Grown is an official sponsor of all of your Canes athletes.
Nice,
so
nice.
That feels really, really good.
That's amazing.
Beating athletes.
Yes,
beating athletes is a part of my ministry.
Yes. Thank you so much, Shannon, for your time.
Thank you,
Felicia. And for the amazing gems that you've shared with us
today.
Thank
you. You're so beautiful. Thank you so much for your light in the universe. I appreciate you.
Awesome. Heineken is proud to support Black Ambition in helping to unlock opportunities for its participating founders.